wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 15th Monday. A big thank you to our KBOO Corps, who have been keeping non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 during this last year. It takes a labor. This morning on the Old Mole, we look at COVID, healthcare as a human right, and labor. Lots and lots of labor. Bill Resnick talks with evolutionary biologist Mike Friedman, who teaches and writes and has studied the COVID pandemic since it appeared. They discuss the recently discovered COVID variants from South Africa, Brazil, England, and more, and the risks they create as our schools and economy reopen. They also discuss what must be done over the next years to protect society and all us humans from the existing COVID pandemic, the variants and also new viruses sure to come that could well be more lethal. Bill left us a hint, quote, "We need a robust, amply funded international public health care system." Luisa Martinez interviews Peter Cole on the second edition of his book titled Ben Fletcher, Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. A gifted labor organizer, Fletcher helped found and lead Local 8 of the IWW's Marine Transport Workers Industrial Union, unquestionably the most powerful interracial union of its era. Taking a principled stand against all forms of xenophobia and exclusion, Luisa and Peter discuss Fletcher's interracial organizing, the repression he faced by the FBI, and what union organizers have to learn from his legacy. We'll conclude today's program with Joe Clement, who continues their conversation with Marianne Garneau, an organizer and educator with the Industrial Workers of the World, about the politics of direct action and organizing for power on the job. They consider the ever-present labor realities of speed-ups and doing more with less, how an ounce of shutting down the workplace is worth a pound of public support, and what control over work looks like when it's not just withdrawal of labor. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Mike Friedman.
Hi, Mike Friedman. Welcome to KBOO to continue discussing the COVID pandemic and those yet to come.
Hi, Bill. Good to be with you again.
Mike Friedman is an evolutionary biologist studying microbes, teaching and writing in the biology department in the University of Antigua and Barbuda. For the last several years, he's been studying and writing on the development of dangerous viruses around the planet, including COVID-19. It's well on its way to killing over 500,000 people in this country by the end of the month, close to 3,000 per day. And that's only officially. It's surely an undercount because many die at home, never diagnosed, and that death toll could go astronomically higher if any of the variants now surfacing are not impacted by the current vaccines, which is quite possible. So, Mike Friedman, lots of people are clamoring to open up, especially in the schools, although perhaps more are reluctant to send their kids. Lots of parents who want the schools to open. In any event, Biden has announced an intention to open the schools in 100 days. Randy Weingarten, the national president of the American Federation of Teachers, wants to reopen, but only when they are safe, but she's apparently very flexible about that. In addition, and more important, as you point out, our financial and business elites, especially the big companies, are unanimous in wanting to stay open, and they haven't even been politically challenged. Oxford, or people all over the country, with Trump in the lead, are rebelling against any steps to halt the virus, even masking. And many states and cities have already functionally reopened, and reopening is sure to greatly increase in the next months. It appears that our political and corporate elites are banking on, the more informed people in the elites are praying, that the vaccines work and against all the variants. But that is very dubious. Mike Friedman, tell us about the limitations of the vaccine and the risks that the variants pose.
Okay, so the vaccine, as quite a few people, experts, have noted, is not a magic bullet. People hold out the illusion that the vaccine is going to produce herd immunity. And these vaccines are not actually designed to do that. So the first problem with the vaccines is that they're not meant to block transmission of the virus. They're meant to block the symptoms of the virus, to block the severe symptoms of the virus. So they will, and they're effective at that. In the case of the Moderna and the Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, they prevented upwards of 90% of deaths and severe hospitalizations. So they do that job. But the problem is that the way the immune system works, you have a component of your immune system which produces antibodies in circulation, and you have a component of your immune system which produces antibodies in your mucous membranes. These vaccines induce antibody production in circulation, and they produce an antibody called IgG. That means they will lower the viral load in your blood and viral reproduction in your cells. They don't affect what's known as IgA, immunoglobulin A, if I'm getting that right, which is the antibody which is produced in your mucous membranes, which means they don't block transmission, they don't block infection, which means you're transmitting and being infected by the virus. So
there's no herd immunity then, basically.
Well, herd immunity is based on transmission, right? So it's incorrect to talk about herd immunity. The AstraZeneca virus showed itself to be 60% effective in halting asymptomatic cases, which means that it does affect transmission, but the way it's affecting transmission is simply by lowering the viral load in your blood or in your system. It doesn't stop transmission. Even if 60% is a uniform effectiveness of the virus, that's not enough to induce herd immunity. So that's the first problem.
Then there's a variant problem.
That's what I was going to get at. So the second problem is the production of mutations, basically. Viruses all mutate, and that was expected. This virus apparently mutates less than other viruses, like the flu virus, but it still mutates. And when you're talking about millions and millions, hundreds of millions of cases globally, you're talking about a large number of variants emerging, and that's exactly what happened. And then natural selection takes over. So natural selection favors mutations that allow the virus to transmit more easily or are more virulent. So we end up with these mutations, these variants emerging in South Africa, Britain, and Brazil, which have the potential for replacing the original virus because they outcompete it. And the problem is the conditions that we've allowed to develop with the virus favor these variants. So when you have ongoing cases and you have proliferation of millions of cases and you have socioeconomic stratification, which make these certain groups more vulnerable, you're actually favoring the proliferation of these variants. And some experts predict that by March, the British variant B.1.1.7 will be the predominant variant in the U.S., and other experts predict that by May we'll have another surge, which will be dominated by these variants. The British variant is possibly 50% more transmissible, and some indications, as you noted, some indications are that it's more lethal or it has a higher virulence than the original virus. Again, with the South African variant, there's a much higher rate of transmission and also a higher virulence. And in fact, in the case of the South African variant, AstraZeneca had to completely suspend its vaccines in South Africa because a clinical study showed that they were ineffective at preventing moderate to severe cases.
Yeah, I read that the South African variant has come to the United States, although the United States has such a poor system of identifying genomes, but they have identified the genome, and the variant is apparently, with our very poor system, when you calculate it, it's doubling every 10 days. Doubling every 10 days means in not too many months, you're going to get huge numbers. And once the numbers get huge enough, doubling becomes enormous. A million doubled in 10 days is 2 million.
Yeah, but it's not pure math. I mean, we live in a very geographically and demographically heterogeneous setting. So people don't all live together. They live spread out in different areas. You have population centers. You have groupings that are more exposed at work. You have groupings that are more exposed in their residences, or in case of homeless people, lack of residences. So it won't spread uniformly, which means that you can't really say exactly how long it's going to take to spread out. But the fact is that it will eventually outcompete and come to predominate in cases in the U.S. And so they are predicting that some predictions are that there'll be another surge by May, even though we're giving vaccines, despite Biden's vaccination.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Mike Friedman on KBOO, KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Mike's an evolutionary biologist who teaches, writes, has studied the COVID pandemic since it appeared. So far, we've discussed the recently discovered COVID variants from South Africa, Brazil, England, and probably more coming, all somewhat different, and the risk they create as within a society that basically ignoring lots of factors. We also talked about the vaccines and the value of the vaccine, which is to lower the symptoms, but it does not lower the transmissions.
Well, it does. It lowers it somewhat, but it lowers it somewhat because the viral load is lower. But it doesn't block it from escaping from your body or coming into your body.
Yes, Mike, let's discuss what could be done. We could come to successfully control viruses. Some countries have, in fact. Very unlikely that all of them will cooperate. But just as a sort of a theoretical intervention, tell us how we could get out of this terrible pandemic and in the process create capacity to defeat other coming viruses.
Okay. The panorama is that we've just been through 40 years of neoliberal restructuring in many, if not all, of the countries of the world, and in the U.S. in particular. That includes downsizing the public health infrastructure. That means privatizing and limiting access to health care. That means creating other conditions that favor social determinants that produce ill health and complicate our ability to deal with the virus. That means, I mean, obviously conditions like racism, like class structure in the U.S., create higher risk for what we're calling comorbidities in the population. So this has been going on for 40 years. Our health systems, public health, health care are shambles. Biden has given indications he wants to bolster a system which has been falling apart for 40 years and which under Trump has taken an even harder hit. So one thing that needs to be done is this healthcare infrastructure needs to be restored. That means surveillance, as you pointed out. That means contact tracing. That means coordination. That means community outreach, for vaccines. So we need all of that. But in the most immediate sense, in order to halt the surge, what we would have to do is bring the viral reproductive rate down to zero. Not to one, to zero. We'd want to stop reproduction of the virus. And to do that, I think ideally, in an ideal world, you would want to have kind of a reboot where you shut everything down for maybe between 2 weeks and 6 weeks, which should be time enough to halt viral reproduction and shedding, and then restart. And you restart under conditions that we've been calling for since the beginning of the pandemic, with adequate social distancing, with masks, with an excellent testing and tracing system, And I want to highlight the fact that our public health system has for years in the U.S. ignored the workplace. I mean, look at OSHA's record at enforcing occupational safety and health at the workplace. It's not great. Their surveillance has been not great. Their enforcement has been not great. And same with the other regulatory agencies. So we need to begin to focus on the workplace, which is a predominant place of spread for the virus. We need to begin to surveil the workplace, collect data, and have transparency in this data so that people could work with it. You also have to have enforcement. And to his credit, Biden has given orders for OSHA to begin to monitor meatpacking plants. We'll see how far that goes. So I think that with these things in place and a shutdown and then a reboot, that would be the way to go. Now, this has to happen not just in the U.S., but around the world, which means you need global coordination. Don't forget, we're talking about ideals here. So you need the type of coordination that would allow you to monitor and to control outbreaks in this enormous globe of ours in remote areas. So that's basically what we would need. The reality is that we are going to have a patchwork response globally, and the response in the U.S., even given Joseph Biden's good intentions, is going to be conditioned by both the past and by his current adhesion to what big business wants, and also to the political fragmentation in the U.S. As you said, we're an extremely polarized state politically, complicated by the rise of the right, which has been facilitated by this neoliberal policy of the past 40 years. And that greatly complicates our ability to implement these containment measures. So, I mean, I envision that there are going to be, like there have been attacks on abortion clinics, there are going to be attacks on vaccination clinics. So we have to deal with that too. The reality is that I think, in my opinion, that we're going to see an endemic virus, which will be controlled in areas, will spring up in other areas, and this will go on for some time.
It's a grim picture. It seems to me one thing that can be done that would actually save a lot of lives, I'm sure the drug companies, they want to make their profits, are busily trying to figure out how to do it, and that is to find drugs, medicines, devices, treatment methods, whatever it is they can make money on, which they can do now because there are so many patients. They ignore any disease that doesn't make them huge amounts of money, but this one could.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the CDC is also thinking about this and putting money into it. That is, just find a drug that reduces, like the vaccines, that reduces the symptoms and leads to a lot less death. That's something actually that can be done, and the Trumpies will not stop it. They probably don't even understand it. Anyway, they can't stop that. And is there anything that we can personally do to reduce the chances that we will get it?
Yeah, I mean, like I said at the outset, we need an overall strategy in which vaccines play an important part. There's no doubt about it, but they're not, like I said, the magic bullet. There's also a role for these drugs. And the problem here is that now there's a nanobody treatment which has been devised, which would be cheaper and easier than antibodies, but it would be a passive immunity. It wouldn't be an active immunity where your immune system is engaged in churning out antibodies. There are various pharmaceuticals which have appeared. And the problem is with a private pharmaceutical industry, profits are always going to be the bottom line. They're not going to produce them, and they're not going to distribute them unless they're going to make money. And some of these are very expensive, some of these drugs. But how are you going to get them to poor communities in the mountains in Ecuador? People can't afford them there. And already we have a big gap in terms of vaccines being delivered to the global south. So I think one thing that we need to consider is taking this production, well, maybe distribution initially, but production later, out of the hands of the pharmaceutical companies. And there's been a move to de-patent the vaccines, for example. So I think that we need to look at this in terms of an overall strategy, which includes some individual behaviors, but I would downplay individual behaviors, because individual behaviors, and as health educators would say, knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs, are formed by broader policies and ideological trends. And we've seen what happens politically when this becomes a question of partisan politics. So this has to start at the top. There needs to be health education, and it needs to be based on it. It needs to be based on engagement with communities so that you're getting community people to do the education. I saw this in vaccine campaigns in Nicaragua, where the communities were responsible for doing their vaccinations. So you need to, at an individual level, we need to wear masks, we need to social distance, we need to stay at home, as Samuel Jackson says. And these things are all conditioned by the larger society. So how are you going to stay home if you're not getting health benefits, if you're not getting sick leave, if you're not getting income? If you have to choose between working to feed your family or staying home to protect your family. So all of these have to be taken into account when we're dealing with individual behaviors. So it's fine to say wear a mask and so on, but we need to be able to provide the proper conditions. And as someone pointed out to me, the only way we're going to do this is not individually, but collectively. This has to come from the bottom up. We have to be on top of the administration, and if it doesn't do its job, we need to supersede it.
Mike Friedman, thanks so much for talking to us today. It's a grim picture, but there are points of light, seems to me, and at some point that movement that you're talking about, it's certainly growing. It has to grow faster.
I would also just like to make one plug. There is an organization which has begun, which includes people like Jeremy Corbyn and others, and people can look for that on the internet. The organization is called the Zero COVID Coalition, and they have a Facebook page which you can look for. It's in Great Britain, but they've had international calls, and they are about formulating a broad strategy to eliminate coronavirus. Their email address is zero_COVID_coalition@outlook.com.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today. It was really good talking to you.
You too, Bill. And be safe.
You too. So long.
That was a bit of the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows. Next on The Old Mole, Luisa Martinez interviews Peter Cole on the second edition of his book titled Ben Fletcher, Life and Times of a Black Wobbly. Peter Cole is a professor of history at Western Illinois University in Macomb and a research associate in the Society Work and Development Institute at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. Cole is the author of the award-winning Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area, and Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And he is the founder and co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. Luisa?
Peter, thanks so much for joining us. The IWW was founded as an anti-racist organization because they understood racial divisions as a tool for the bosses to maintain control over workers. Could you explain why the IWW organizer Ben Fletcher was considered so dangerous to both the capitalist class and then later on the FBI?
Yeah, of course. Fletcher was so dangerous because he was a revolutionary young black worker who has taken the leadership role in what could be the most large, militant, multiracial, multiethnic union in the country in that era, the 19-teens, the World War I era. Of course, the IWW was also hated by, as you say, both capitalists and the government. And that didn't mean just Fletcher, but really to be a Wobbly was to have a target on your back, especially once World War I began, because it was the largest, most influential union in the United States and the world, really, before World War I, that was committed very overtly to getting rid of capitalism and instituting a socialist world economy. And so Fletcher was a part of this revolutionary milieu, but the fact that he was himself an African-American who led a incredibly diverse union that controlled one of the largest waterfronts in the country, that also was why Fletcher in particular was arrested and then tried and later imprisoned, along with a bunch of other Wobblies in 1918.
In your intro, you state that you don't attempt to kind of extradite Ben Fletcher's life from the life and history of his union of Local 8. I'm curious, why did you choose that route as opposed to, you know, a more straightforward biography about an unusually talented organizer in the face of multiple types of oppression?
Yeah, there is a lot of ways one, I suppose, could approach it. As a historian, I have always sort of been interested in unions and social movements more broadly, essentially how people collectively have more power than they have individually, and how most of the great changes in the country and world that have occurred have happened in that way, right? Organized collective action, and that workers in particular have more power than other groups of people, arguably than at the ballot box. So for me, I guess I saw the union as really the key story in and of himself. Fletcher is not important. It's because of what he was able to do and considering who he was. I mean, but he was one person. One person doesn't change the world. But when one person, as a part of a group of 5,000 workers, are able to sort of really radically improve their own lives, change their conditions, and then also sort of be a part of a much larger organization, to me, that's actually the story. But there's also the reality that the ordinary people of the past have very little written about them. They themselves didn't keep such good records. They didn't keep journals, write diaries. The correspondence that they might have had or did have is often lost. And so it's very hard, actually, to tell a book-length story about an individual who isn't an elite person. And since Ben Fletcher was both a working-class man, but also an African-American in the early 20th century, the truth is that there's a lot we don't know about him. And so what we do know about him is, in particular, his role, his sort of central role in sort of organizing Philadelphia dock workers, and then being sort of an important player in the industrial works of the world nationwide, that we know. What he liked for breakfast, his personal relationships, but sadly, we know very, very little about those parts of his life. And so to me, it's really sort of in a way a sort of the public life of Ben Fletcher. I'd love to and would be deeply interested in knowing much more about Ben Fletcher's personal life. But sadly, we don't have that information anymore. And he had no children and no sort of collection of papers. And so the approach that I took for writing this biography, I think, was logical in for multiple ways. But it's really because of what he did as a part of this organization, right? I mean, leaders matter, but leaders only matter if they have a lot of followers. And so Fletcher was so interesting because he led this incredibly powerful, militant, multiracial union in a time when racism and xenophobia and anti-unionism was the norm.
IW's insistence, it wasn't just acceptance of racial and gender unity, it was insistence around it, are supported certainly by the historical texts you cite, but it's also evident that representation was important as well. And so how did either Local 8 or Fletcher himself understand these concepts, and how did it inform Wobbly organizing at that time?
Yeah, you can't imagine Ben Fletcher being a part of any organization other than the IWW in the 19-teens, because when the IWW was founded in 1905, it was very intentionally founded by revolutionaries and radicals, men and women, who were not only anti-capitalists, but also were understood deeply that racism and sexism sort of were part of the equation of how essentially the ruling class divides and conquers the working class. And simultaneously, Fletcher believes that, as far as we know. He was a great organizer and supposedly a brilliant speaker and very funny man, but his paper trail is limited, right? And so what we know about Fletcher's sort of thoughts on these matters is that at some level, Fletcher believed that Black workers were no different than other sorts of workers, that capitalism was the primary source of oppression, and that working class people needed to organize across all divisions within them in order to sort of overcome capitalism. At the same time, as a Black man whose parents very possibly were born enslaved, even though we don't know for sure, but we know that his parents were born in Virginia in the 1850s, you wouldn't have to tell Ben Fletcher that Black people got a particularly raw deal in the United States. And so I don't want to understate the realities of racism and that as a Black man, he wasn't anti-racist. But as a socialist, he actually believed that the only and best path forward is through sort of multiracial unionism in particular. I would also point out for people who may not be thinking about it is that in the 1920s, the teens and 20s, there was a very large Black organization in the U.S. and the world called the Universal Negro Improvement Association, led by Marcus Garvey. And Garvey was this brilliant Jamaican political revolutionary who lived in Harlem and had over a million people belong to his organization in multiple countries. But Garveyism was a separatist. And so for someone like Fletcher, if he's thinking about, you know, okay, we need to form Black worker unions, that would make sense given discrimination against Black people. But simultaneously, you have this separatist organization that really is putting race first in a way that Fletcher and other socialists rejected, and that Garvey really wasn't thinking at all about capitalism. He actually just wanted to be a part of capitalism. He just wanted a fair shake for Black people, but didn't trust white people to make it happen. So we can understand Fletcher in the context of his time as being much more interested in interracial unionism as opposed to sort of Black organizations. And that made him similar to people like A. Philip Randolph, probably the best known labor and socialist African-American who comes out of that same era. Although Fletcher dies much earlier than Randolph, so Randolph is also much better known.
So let me ask, what do you think, considering there's so limited information in terms of his early life, even his personal life, do you have a particular theory for why he went that route?
So that's a great question. It's an important question. And my answer is sort of weak. I have opinions. I guess I would call them educated opinions, but I don't know. We don't even know precisely when he joined the IWW. It was probably around 1910. He was born in 1890, so he was about 20 years old. Might have been 1911. But so we know about when he joined. He also pretty certainly, but not definitively, joined the Socialist Party of America at that time or around that time. And that would have been common. There was a lot of Wobblies who were socialists and vice versa. Big Bill Haywood was a famous Wobbly leader who also in that same moment was also a member of the Socialist Party. But so we can guess here's this poor Black guy. He suffers like most sort of working class kids would have in Philadelphia in the first decade of the 20th century. He didn't finish high school, although he's clearly very smart and well-read based on the correspondence that we can read and that are included in the book. But it's not because of a formal education. He probably finished school by the age of 15 or 16 at best. And so I surmised that Fletcher was walking down the streets of his neighborhood in Philadelphia, which was a working class area, industrial areas, lots of people, not just Black people. It wasn't really segregated the way it later became, right? And that he probably started to meet and hear Wobbly speakers on the streets. He later, shortly thereafter, I should say, became a very well-known soapbox speaker in Philadelphia and neighboring towns. And so it's reasonable to conclude that he basically was sort of organized by some Wobblies who, you know, chatted him up, maybe gave him a newspaper like Solidarity or Industrial Worker, maybe sort of set him aside. He probably watched more than once before he decided to sort of maybe take a pamphlet or come back. But that he was convinced because of his life experience, but also probably because, well, the Wobblies were already organizing in his neighborhood in the city of Philadelphia. And that he also joined the Socialist Party it's pretty clear that he has already at a young age, right, rejected capitalism as the preferred economic system that humans should live under. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how the government investigated Fletcher that, you know, ultimately led to this trial, particularly, and I'm reading from your book here, for chapter 17, this is a report made by Agent Henry Bowen to what we now understand to be the FBI. It was then the U.S. Department of Justice Bureau of Investigation. But He's writing this report about Fletcher, and he says, this is, you know, before they had entered his house, another agent entered his house pretending to be a health inspector. It's just kind of a follow-up visit. And he writes, Fletcher is a real type of Southern N-word agitator, obviously self-censoring here. With no education, poor grammar, he is about 5'9 in height, weighs 185 pounds, and is reputed by the police as a bad man or gunfighter. He did not display any of that to agent. In reference to other matters about articles purported to be written by a, quote, colored citizen, in which the draft act is criticized, does not think Fletcher capable of expressing himself in the same manner as these matters have been expressed. Agent feels that Fletcher is not very harmful to the U.S. government. Later on, of course, he was indicted, and he showed up a couple hours late to his to the trial, and even then had to demonstrate ID that he actually he needed to be inside the courtroom because the bailiff wouldn't let him in. So my question is, how did the constant undermining of Fletcher's intelligence work in favor of his organizing, if only for, you know, limited time?
Well, like there's a bunch of good questions sort of embedded in there. But it's interesting, actually, because this agent Bowen, right, who's this sort of federal agent who's spying on Fletcher, surveying him in Boston, where he's living in the summer of 1917. It's not clear, actually, that he knows Fletcher. It's so interesting because he says he's 5'9 and weighs 185. Well, actually, no, he was 5'4, right? And although he was stocky, I doubt actually he weighed 185. And he totally sort of is duped by Fletcher, you know, that Fletcher basically is playing a role for Bowen if he's this real Southern agitator, because of course he's not even Southern, he's from Philadelphia. Okay. And so there's so many things we might think about. But, you know, the bigger issues are, first and foremost, like you said, he's being spied on. America declares war in April 1917. Really, less than 2 months later, the U.S. Congress creates the Espionage Act. Later, the following year, the Sedition Act added. But the Espionage Act that basically criminalizes dissent. And then 2 months into the war, U.S. part of the war, they're already basically have Fletcher and many other wobblies in the sort of May-June of 1917 under surveillance. There wasn't even time for the IWW to organize the resistance to the war if they had chosen to. And they've already been targeted, right? And so let us keep it without any evidence that Fletcher has in fact done anything wrong. He's already been spied on. It's interesting that they find him in Boston. He had been in Norfolk earlier in 1917, where he was organizing, and was threatened with lynching, according to his local friends. And so he was smuggled onto a ship and went up to Boston. And then he just lived in Boston for a few months. And he actually ended up marrying a woman in Boston that same time. And then is sort of, as he's being surveyed, and then when he's indicted, as were 150 other wobblies, rather than turn himself in, he was not obligated to do so, although some did, he just sort of hung out. And then he and his new wife and his stepchild basically lived sort of in Philadelphia, his home city, until the police got around to finding him 5 months later, practically. And so the stories are sort of fascinating if we're thinking about Fletcher's life experience in this moment. He'll then sort of, as you said, get on a train and go to Chicago, because the federal trial is against the entire IWW leadership in Chicago, which was the headquarters of the IWW. And, you know, then he has to sort of almost convince the prison guards to let him into the courtroom, because they don't even know really who the hell this guy is. But Fletcher apparently is honest enough to travel across country and turn himself into court, where even though he knew that fair trial was unlikely given the sort of the hostility that the IWW already experienced from the U.S. federal government.
In past interviews, you said you're a historian who believes we study the past, understand the present, and change the future. Thank you so much, Peter, for spending time and talking about your book.
We conclude this morning's program with Joe Clement, continuing their conversation with Marianne Garneau, an organizer and educator with the Industrial Workers of the World. This is part two of a three-part interview. Part 3 will air next week on February 22nd, and Part 1 aired on February 8th. You can find that on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Joe?
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking again today with Marianne Garneau of the IWW and the publisher of Organizing Work, a publication that offers a chance for workers to look at what works and what doesn't when it comes to organizing our workplaces and changing our society from that point. We were talking about an article that she wrote for Organizing Work last year about big strikes and the sabotage of labor. And when we left off, we were talking about speed up. How does scientific management still show itself as an issue for workers? Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, industrial capitalism 100 years ago. We hear it all the time how unions were okay for a certain historical time because that's what we needed, but we don't need it anymore. In what ways are we still kind of living 100 years ago?
Well, I think if you look at the charts or graphs of the increase in productivity continues to grow and wages do not. So the bottom line is that workers are producing more outputs, they're doing more, they're generating more without really getting paid more. And wherever you work, especially right now, this is happening with coronavirus pandemic, every time they lay someone off and don't replace them, that's basically a speed up. Every time that you get handed another person, another half of a person's job function, or every time you work a little short-staffed, or every time you're expected to do basically the same or more with less, that's the speed up. And that's been slowly going, that's been going on for decades. It's been going on probably since the beginning of capitalism, but it's, if you look at the numbers, it's really been stark in the last several decades. There are a couple of specialized names that have been given to this in the roughly, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. One is lean production and one is just-in-time supply chain. And we're seeing those during the coronavirus pandemic too, because used to have, let's say, 25 ICU beds in a hospital, and now they have like 6. And the philosophy is, well, why would we pay for 25 beds when most of the time, 20 of them are going to sit idle? It's not worth the cost. It's not worth the maintenance. So let's just have 6, which is the average amount that we need. And then, of course, what happens is you get a pandemic and suddenly you need 25, if not 50, and you don't have them. That's a philosophy that's been applied to basically everything in capitalism, whether it has to turn a profit or not. If you work in education, you've experienced this. If you work in healthcare, you've experienced this. And certainly if you work in a factory, you've experienced this, where let's work with as few workers as possible, working as hard as possible, and everything arrives just in time. Everything is made to be as efficient as possible. And then when you have, again, a pandemic, there are no masks, there are no testing kits, there's no vaccinations because we've shut down most production to make it as lean as possible.
You start to anticipate what I wanted to ask next about how in your article, a lot of the examples of shop floor power that you describe focus on these kind of traditional industrial settings of factories, mines, ports. Do we need to think differently about shop floor power in these kind of workplace contexts where the employer is the main and first consumer of workers' labor versus settings that are now kind of the norm for workers in this economy where you're working with the public, you're serving people, and setting aside how consumers and customers are awful, a lot of people like to serve the public in the ways they do. And it creates this barrier to thinking about your power on the job as something that belongs to you rather than to the people you serve.
There's a lot wrapped up in that. One thing I want to describe is how the significance of the way the IWW was organizing in its heyday. So it started in 1905 and, you know, continued through the early 1920s before a fairly precipitous decline, but it's still around today. Like I said, I'm a member and I'm not trying to boost it out of organizational chauvinism, but because any historian will say, and any labor person will say, there was something rather unique about the IWW's approach to how it organized. One of the things that was unique about its approach and still is that it wanted to organize unskilled workers. So prior to that, to an extent, the labor movement had functioned by taking skilled labor, skilled craft labor, and kind of putting a bit of a fence around it and bargaining with implicit leverage by virtue of owning that skilled labor and employers needing it, right? So if all of the master craftsmen in some particular field can say, we're in an organization now, and this is the rate at which we want to be paid, because it's not easy to find that kind of skilled craftsman and or to replace it or to duplicate that, you have to bargain with them. Whereas unskilled labor, and we've probably all experienced this, if you don't like it, there's the door, right? Is what the boss's attitude is. You're replaceable. There are far more of you and more of you to go around. And you don't have the bargaining leverage as a result of being irreplaceable or having possession of some particular skill. Even though it is a bit of a the notion of unskilled labor is a bit of a misnomer anyway, because, okay, go ahead, try to make a cappuccino in 30 seconds and try to make 50 of them in a row and make the latte foam pretty and whatever. You can't, right? Only a barista can do that. The IWW's approach was to organize this so-called unskilled labor. And that meant that your leverage had to be of a different kind. And it meant that you had to really gather absolutely everybody working in an industry, working in a mine, working in forestry, working in a mill, and make them willing to withdraw their labor. And again, the point of the article is that didn't just look like a big walkout strike every couple of years. Sometimes it looked like shutting down the machines for the day. Sometimes it looked like folding your arms and refusing to do a certain thing at a certain time. Lots of little strikes. But the approach was basically to organize unskilled labor to be able to withdraw its labor when it wanted to. The reason why I still think that's relevant today is because a lot of us do work in, let's say the service industry or jobs that are considered unskilled. And most people in capitalism, and this has basically always been true, are in a position where their leverage is not being the rare possessor of a particular skill or craft, but being, a worker who works alongside other workers. And if they can develop the ability to act collectively, they can withdraw their labor as leverage.
And I think the principle, it sounds like, is the same, whether it's the craft or the industrial context. It's that it's easier to replace the labor of so-called unskilled workers, and that when you do it collectively, what becomes harder is replacing the number of unskilled workers that would represent. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marianne Garneau, organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing Work, talking today about her article Big Strikes and the Sabotage of Labor, about the politics of shop floor power in the labor movement. Also on today's show, we have an interview with author Peter Cole about a biographical book he wrote about Ben Fletcher, who was organizing in the Philadelphia docks in the 19-teens and 20s with the IWW in its infamous Local 8. Marianne, you talked to Peter Cole last year on the Wobcast, the podcast for Organizing Work, and I want to ask you to relate a point you brought up then to our conversations today, how organizing for power on the job over the work process itself. Workers in the IWW Local 8 in the time of Ben Fletcher's leadership abolished segregation on the docks, in the workplace, in dock life, and that this is the real political import of labor's power, is to directly transform the world.
Yeah, so it was interesting because, first of all, I think that Local 8, so the IWW Local that the dock workers organized in Philadelphia with the help of Ben Fletcher, was very interesting because it was a great example of workers really controlling the job and taking action directly on the job in order to get what they want. So they secured significant increases in wages and overtime rates, and most importantly, they replaced the shape-up system where bosses could basically handpick who worked on the docks with a hiring hall, which meant that employers had to come to the union in order to get labor to work for them on the docks. And they desegregated work on the docks, which is a really remarkable feat for 1912 and for this period, especially considering that Philadelphia, like everywhere else in the United States, was deeply segregated, was very much a white supremacist society overall. And the fact that workers were able to do this through their own application of their labor power, basically, is a great illustration of the way that of what workers and labor can accomplish. And also, how powerful they are, including actually, especially when working outside of the formal contract and bargaining system.
Thanks for making that connection. I want to go back to what we were talking about a bit earlier about what these shop floor struggles look like or could look like in a contemporary context, and ask you to speak on the concern that workers universally have when it comes to going on strike, but especially workers who are somehow serving the public directly, whether that's in the public sector or in the service sector.
So yeah, there's a bit of a concern where if what I do on a day-to-day level is teach children or deliver healthcare or facilitate the public's self-education by working in a library, then if I withhold my labor, the sufferer is going to be the community, the sick, the children, the poor, et cetera. The reality is that nurses, for example, have always struck. And when they strike, what they do is they prepare plans so that management nurses are the ones that have to do the work. Teachers likewise have struck. Sometimes school thereby gets shut down. But when teachers are striking, they are striking for things that not only improve their own working conditions, but that also serve the public interest. Like, let's have smaller class sizes. Let's have better funding for schools and for non-academic extracurricular activities. Let's have better social welfare supports for students in the schools. So it's a misnomer to say that those workers can't strike or withdraw their labor. And it's also a misnomer to say that when they do so, they are simply hurting the public, as opposed to looking after the public's long-term interests. And I think that one of the things we've seen in the pandemic, again, is that one of the few institutions in society that has not only been looking after the public's interests, but has had the muscle to enforce the best practices for public health have been unions. Unions have been the one to shut down schools from in-person learning when infection rates were simply far too high. In some cases, they were simply holding local government jurisdictions to their word that they wouldn't open schools if the infection rate, transmission rate was above a certain percentage point. And the public authorities were going back on their word, and teachers' unions were holding them to that. In a lot of cases, in the case of healthcare workers, they're the ones who have insisted on having adequate PPE and adequate staffing levels, not so that they feel better, but so that COVID doesn't blow through a hospital or a long-term care facility like wildfire, and it doesn't just spread from one place to another place to another place. Speaking of which, there are all kinds of ways you can see capitalism has organized work that has contributed to the spread of COVID, where, for example, if most of the people who are working in long-term care facilities make very little money and therefore have to work in more than one place at a time, and they became vectors for the spread of the disease. And so when they demand higher wages and benefits and better scheduling and full-time hours, that's not just a selfish concern on their part. That's something that is holding the public health at stake. So striking is something that's completely available, and labor disruption is and should be available to public sector workers, and that is in the community interest. And I've been writing about this lately. There's a whole debate on bargaining for the common good. But as far as how much public support you need to carry out a strike, it certainly helps. It certainly makes those workers feel better. But I think what we've seen is that the real leverage that gets the job done and that carries the day is those workers withholding their labor or threatening to withhold their labor. That, an ounce of that is worth a pound of public support in terms of actually getting those demands met.
What I've noticed is that in the framing of like bargaining for the common good, there's a recognition that there is a need to incorporate the public that gets served into the mutual aid process. Because when you go out on strike and you're not getting pay, that means that you need some kind of alternative support network. And with public sector workers, there's people who need some kind of support that the public sector workers on strike, you know, are withholding. And in the case of like the Red for Ed teachers, there was extensive and months-long preparation in terms of making sure that those support networks existed. But with a shop floor struggle attitude about it being, you know, something that we decide when it comes up on the shop floor, if that means up to and walking out for the day, but you don't have those preparations in line, I wonder whether you just run into the issue that would affect a big strike of simply calling a strike without having preparations.
Yes. So let me explain, I think, for the sake of the audience, that when I describe the day-to-day shop floor struggle, describe sabotage, but also when workplaces started to be formally organized, more formally organized and unions actually recognized in the workplace through these official legal processes, what that looked like did not look how it looks today, where it's sort of this very orderly process, the grievance process that ends in arbitration, as I said, and the, you know, formal bargaining process. What it looked like, and I'll read an excerpt from, again, one of the historical pieces I quoted. What it looked like was this. At Studebaker, it became, so, you know, auto factory, It became standard practice for shop stewards to meet every morning to plan their approach to the day's work. So shop stewards, workers, planning their approach to the day's work. Exercising effective control over the company's piece rate pay system, they thought of the foremen, the bosses, as just clerks. In the farm equipment industry, stewards held a veto over the work norms set by supervision. And at Armour's main Chicago plant, packing house union stewards developed a tactic they called whistle bargaining. Each steward wore a whistle around his or her neck. Whenever a supervisor declined to discuss a grievance, the steward gave a blast on the whistle and the department halted work. When the issue was resolved, the steward whistled twice and production started again. So that kind of immediate stop and go, screw it, we're downing tools until this particular grievance is fixed. And a lot of those grievances had to do with the pace of work, right? That's what the labor movement used to look like, which is absolutely unheard of today.
I've been talking with Marianne Garneau, organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing Work, that is found at organizing.work, about her article Big Strikes and the Sabotage of Labor. Tune in next week to hear us round out our conversation about the politics of shop floor power and workers' direct capacity to change their workplace and the world. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.
Anne Feeney, American folk musician, singer, songwriter, political activist, and attorney. Anne Feeney died from COVID-19 on February 3rd, 2020. She was 69 years old. We will have much more on Anne Feeney's life and work in the coming month. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick, Mike Friedman, Luisa Martinez, and Peter Cole, Joe Clement, and Marianne Garneau. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.